Okay. Everybody's back. Everybody but a couple of board members. Let me just check on the phone. Sandy, are you back on the phone?
Yeah, I was here when you called on me before. I just couldn't get off mute fast enough. Sorry about that. It was locked and another app was open and I'm like, oh, sorry about that.
That happens. Don, are you on the phone?
He's joining again for the...
Okay. All right then. Back to pensions. And we are on to 3B. Take it away.
All right, thank you. Welcome back. So paper 3B analyzes the feedback on the proposed amendments to IS-19. Similar to the format of our previous discussion, we'll discuss our analysis of each issue and ask if you agree with our recommendation before we move on to the next question. The first proposed amendment to IS-19 relates to how an entity accounts for defined benefit plan when a plan event, which is, I'm using the word plan event to refer to plan amendment, curtailment, or settlement, occurs during a reporting period. The proposed amendments specify that an entity should use updated assumptions to calculate current service cost and net interest when the entity remeasures the net defined benefit liability or asset. This is because the board was concerned that ignoring the effects of a plan event does not result in useful information. As we discussed briefly in July, the key issues that were identified relate to the consequences of having a minor plan amendment and inconsistency with the requirements in IS 34. So I'll first talk about the consequences of a minor plan amendment, which was referred to as issue one in the paper. Paragraph 12 summarizes the concerns raised by respondents in this respect. Some respondents say it's not clear how an entity would apply the general requirements about materiality in the context of these amendments. In particular, they're concerned that the proposed amendments could lead to more frequent remeasurements, especially when there's a minor plan amendment. Some respondents also say that the proposed amendment may reduce the comparability of financial statements between entities, for example, where one entity might have a minor plan amendment during a year and another would not. They would report different numbers. And other respondents also say that some entities might adopt computational shortcut methods permitted by IS-19 to reflect the results of minor plan events. These respondents think that entities will now have to undertake a detailed, expensive, and onerous approach because the effects of this plan event could be material. Our analysis of these concerns is presented in paragraph 14 to 22. We do understand these concerns raised by respondents. We agree that they might lead to more frequent remeasurements, especially when these minor plan events occur. Because the board and the committee did not intend to change whether and when an entity remeasures the net defined benefit liability, we recommend amending the scope of these amendments to exclude such minor plan events. We think this can be achieved by adding a criterion specifying that an entity applies the proposed amendments only if the plan event affects a significant proportion of employees covered by the plan. In other words, an entity would use updated assumptions to measure current service cost and net interest if the net defined benefit liability is remeasured in accordance with paragraph 99 of IS-19, and the second additional criterion that we are proposing also applies. The criterion we are proposing is not a new concept in IS-19. It's already used to identify when a curtailment occurs. We did receive two informal comments on the wording of the criterion that we have used. One member suggested changing the term employee to members to say it affects a significant proportion or number of members covered by the plan. We do agree with that suggestion. And one board observer suggested replacing the word significant proportion of employees with significant number of the employees covered by the plan, because this would be more aligned with the definition of a curtailment. We agree with both these suggestions, and we are proposing that this additional criterion would read as follows: the plan event affects a significant number of the members covered by the plan. The matrix in paragraph 21 of our paper highlights the effect of including this additional criterion, and we think the use of this criterion would address the concerns raised by the respondents for reasons that we've outlined in paragraph 22. I would now like to direct your attention to question 1 on page 8, and ask, firstly, if you agree with our recommendation to amend the scope to exclude minor plan events, and secondly, if you agree with that recommendation, if you agree with the additional criterion that I've just spoken about.
Okay, we're at question one. Comments, reactions? Mary?
When I have a minor one, again, I've mentioned it to the staff before, I just didn't want to surprise anybody. If you look at the table of 21 and paragraph 22, it keeps talking about not required to change. And I think the issue is that you do not, rather than it becomes elective. So then you might need to look at the words not required again. So I think the purpose is to say you remeasure if and only if these events happen, rather than you don't have to, but you could if you
say it should say do not remeasure.
Yeah.
For current service costs and net interest, we will make sure that is clear. In terms of the net defined benefit liability, paragraph 99, the way it's currently applied, it's based on materiality, so it may or may not be applied. Yeah. But on current service cost and net interest, we'll be clear that you need both those criteria. Yeah.
John?
What do you think is significant? I mean, the reason I asked the question is I'm not a fan for something that's a threshold question, which involves such a fairly significant issue as remeasurement or not remeasurement. I'm not a fan of things as sort of loose as significant, because significant is in the eyes of the beholder.
We intend it to be used the same way it's currently used for the definition of a curtailment. So what people are doing in practice for curtailment and how they understand that to be used, we intend it to be used the exact same way, and we would clarify that in the basis that that's the basis for using this terminology. So it comes down to what people are already comfortable with and are applying in practice today.
Makes sense, because often curtailments are affected through an amendment.
Reinhard?
The one concern I had with respect to the proposed amendment is although I understand using number of employees or a significant number of employees to try to distinguish a minor plan amendment from something that's more significant, I'm just wondering if that's the only criterion people should or would use. What I'm getting at is I can envisage an employee group where you enhance the benefits significantly for a certain proportion of the members, but not all. And so it may not be a majority of the members, but overall it has a significant impact on the obligation. And so I would have thought that might be more than a minor plan amendment. So
that's the effect.
Yeah, so I was thinking of more the impact, as Sue was just saying here. Certainly number of employees is one way of doing it. It's just that I'm not comfortable that it would cover all of the types of circumstances.
Yeah, I think that somebody raised the point yesterday, if you increase the benefit to all of the employees over 65, that's likely to have a very significant impact on the measurement, even though it might only be 7 or 8% of the employees. Gary?
I think the curtailment language today focuses a number of pool of the benefits for a significant number of employees. It doesn't say how much the benefits are, but you're right. You get a plan, a lot of 25-year-olds, they got a nominal, defined benefit accrued because you got 30 or 40 years of compounding ahead of you, as well as years of service. But I think you have to do it by number of employees, only for practicality, not necessarily conceptual, because if you're going to do it on defined benefit measures, you're going to have to remeasure the plan. That's what we're trying to avoid doing.
Tony?
I'm not sure that we're trying to avoid remeasuring the plan, because as a matter of fact, you would only apply this guidance if you did have to remeasure the plan. That's what it says. So I think what we're focusing on here is not so... The issue is around the post-amendment income statement impact and the determination of service cost and finance cost post-amendment. So if you wouldn't need to remeasure the plan, then you wouldn't need to reconsider service cost and finance cost. And I share John's concern, and maybe we've been reading the same books or whatever, but I just think this is adding a layer of complexity that I would just let people deal with a materiality judgment. And maybe the example that I would use to illustrate it is one of the concerns we talked about and why we said, yeah, that there ought to be a requirement in the right circumstances to revisit service cost and finance cost is because you could end up with an anomalous result, let's just say, and liability was completely settled and you continue to recognize a service cost, that finance cost, that wouldn't make a whole heap of sense. Well, let's take a situation where we've got a mature plan, only 20% of the employees are active, the remainder are pensioners, and you close the plan to future accrual. You might say that that 20% is not a significant number of employees, but therefore you would end up continuing to recognize a service cost for a period which the service is not actually accruing benefit. And so to my mind, I think this is just adding another judgment, another level of complexity, and I'd rather let people make a materiality call. So that they've had to make one on whether to remeasure the defined benefit obligation, which is what the chart says in its first line. Let them make a materiality judgment as to whether or not they need to remeasure the service cost and the finance cost.
Are you not worried about people choosing, like, doing minor amendments in order to choose to present their service costs and stuff on a different basis?
Cherry picking, in other words.
Yeah.
I think that, again, falls into the same judgment, doesn't it? So if you decide to change the benefits for one employee, then I'm not sure I would necessarily see that as triggering either remeasurement. I think that's what comes back to the judgment.
If you're happy.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the only thing I would say on that is it could change how frequently an entity remeasures the defined benefit liability in account for 99, because currently today when they're looking at the impact of paragraph 99 and whether they have to remeasure the liability, they only have to consider its impact on past service cost or gain or loss in settlement. Now, because this plan event affects three measures in the financial statements, they will have to look at the impact on not just past service cost and gain or loss in settlement, but also what impact this could have on current service cost and net interest. So to take an example of where you might have made a plan amendment for one employee, and if the interest rate has moved significantly during the year, yes, there is a limited impact on past service cost, it's not material, but it will have a material impact on net interest. So the entity would have to remeasure the net defined benefit liability.
But I guess I thought the way that we set this up was to say you only need to think about remeasuring finance cost and service cost if you have to remeasure.
And that's the intention, but I'm not sure that's how it comes across, because the moment you word the amendment the way we have it, it basically implies that you've got to consider everything. You've got to consider all three, and that's part of the concern. And that's why we thought there's a need to scope out finance cost and service cost. First, when people are doing the assessment of 99, you need something to scope out interest and service cost. That was a thought process behind it and why we thought we needed something additional. Then the question is, what is that additional criteria, which we can discuss. But
my understanding was it was only a subset of the, I mean, it was the 99, it was when 99 remeasurement was triggered, which wasn't being tampered with, that you actually had this requirement.
Correct.
So you didn't actually need to assess the materiality of this in the context of whether you needed a 99, prior 99 remeasurement.
Yes, and that is the intention, but the moment you build in to say that you have to update your current service cost and net interest once you have a remeasurement, people are saying it automatically feeds into the cycle. It's almost like a catch-22. That's the problem.
That's
what we were struggling with when we came up with this.
I hadn't read it that way. I thought if you didn't have to remeasure under 99, then you weren't in.
Yeah.
And you didn't have to think about it.
Yeah, and that's definitely the intention.
So couldn't we clarify that?
We'd have to think quite. I think we'd have to think quite carefully about how we worded it, because if we were just saying you remeasure whenever you would remeasure under paragraph 99, but because that remeasurement then has a consequential impact on future service cost and net interest, if we said nothing, the implication I think would definitely be that in assessing whether you got a material change, you'd have to think about the interest costs and the service costs going forward. But we might be able to draft something, but it would be not like anything else I've seen in IFRS that says, in assessing whether this is material, ignore these changes. And that would be quite odd. I mean, maybe we can do it. I haven't tried.
I like John, I'd understood this was a subset.
That's what we want it to be, but I'm not quite sure how don't know the best way of getting to that answer. But to say in assessing materiality you ignore these effects would be a curious interpretation of materiality. It would be different from what we normally do.
Not likely to get
bored. Let's push on. Bertrand?
Yeah, just to say that having read the paper, I thought what the staff proposed was quite balanced. I mean, I totally understand the fact that when there is a curtailment or a service cost, either positive, which is a minus, or negative, which is a plus, you need in theory to remeasure the defined benefit obligation, and then to reassess your P&L expense that was based on the previous year-end valuation. And just practically, we do a yearly valuation of our pension obligations. It is a 6-month process. We release quarterly financial statements, so we don't do every quarter a 6-month process to value our defined benefit obligation. And when you have a curtailment or a past service cost, then effectively I understand the fact that you would need to remeasure your pension obligation and reassess your P&L impact, service cost and interest cost. I perfectly understand that. At the same time, I thought the way the proposals of the staff was quite balanced in the sense that it also focused on the significant impacts and trying to give a definition of what is significant or what is not significant, so as to not just leave everybody alone on assessing their judgment. So I thought it was quite balanced, because it practically, if you think of a yearly process, and then effectively it's an exception to your yearly process in terms of the way we do our pension reporting, effectively it's quite balanced. Then effectively you redo things in certain circumstances when it's effectively the impact would be deemed significant on the defined benefit obligation and on the coming P&L expense or impact, let's say. We had a curtailment in Q1. We accounted for the impact of the curtailment. It was a positive impact of 1 million euro. So we accounted for it. Honestly, we never thought of redoing the whole process of revaluing the defined benefit obligation and to decrease the service cost or the interest cost for the remainder of the year, which would have led to an impact of 0.x million euro, which is totally immaterial at a group level. But I don't see this conflicting. I mean, it's a well-balanced paper between the constraints of the principles on one hand, and the practical things.
Pardon?
Yeah, unfortunately, I have probably also to start with the appendix. For me, the question when we evaluate what is a minor plan event and what affects potentially future service costs, then we have to evaluate the overall mechanism of IRIS 19. And the mechanism of IRIS 19 is that I use actuarial assumptions based on the beginning of the year. This is the mortality rate, this is interest rate, this is fluctuation of my employees. And based on that, I calculate my service costs. Now I have a curtailment or whatever. And the question is, and this is also mentioned in the appendix, it's on page 17 above, but it more or less has to do with the overall question we are discussing here. What kind of input parameters I have to change? And Bertrand also illustrated what is done in practice. You do not go through a whole, calculation procedure or whatever. So if you have such an event, what kind of parameters do you have to change? For sure, the quantitative parameters in terms of the numbers of the employees. The question is whether you have to change your assumptions about fluctuation or your assumption about mortality or so. I would say these parameters more or less are untouched. Why? I also keep all my other plans untouched with regard to these kinds of inputs. Yeah, I mean, we agreed that it wouldn't make sense, probably economically on a cost-benefit basis, to recalculate all other pension plans the company might have in the same country. So the result we will have is a different calculation basis anyhow, because companies who do not have such an event, they keep their former actuarial assumptions. So therefore, the question also in the past was so important for me to focus on these parameters where the company really has, say, an impact on, where the decision of the company has an impact on, and this is potentially the number of the employees, but it's not the mortality rate, it's not interest rate, it's not fluctuation rate. And therefore, again, it probably fits into the whole discussion here, the topic which kind of parameters have to be changed. I know I'm anticipating currently a little bit of question number three, which is related to the appendix and then to a certain topics within the appendix, but more or less with regard to what is a significant amendment, what do we consider in terms of future service costs and so on, it's part of the overall discussion.
Mikhail?
I think generally I like the principle base, and by that materiality should be evaluated by the company and so on, and you should not have rules around that. But in this case, I think we already, to my understanding, when it comes to curtailment, have this materiality rule with significant number of employees, which means that when it is a curtailment, you have these rules with a significant number of employees. But when it comes to settlement, you do not have that. So in my mind, I think this is a good way to get to a situation where you can take away a lot of what we talked about here, calculations, that you do not need to do this evaluation about what could it potentially be for materiality aspects in the different ways. And it's a simplification, of course, but I think that is it's a good one.
Okay. Yang-Su?
I should say that I really like this step idea, including one dimension, such as proportion of the employees affected by the plan event. We could solve many problems raised by the commentators. So in that sense, I really like that. But I have just one concern. One of the commentator pointed out that even if the proportion of the employees affected by the plan event is not significant, sometimes the effect of the change in the plan onto the current service cost and in the net interest would be material. But if we just apply this one, that material, you know, the impact on the current service cost and net interest is not going to be reported in any part of the financial statements. So what I'm concerning is that, you know, that if that current cost, the effect of the current cost, service cost, and net interest is big, significant material.
So you're talking
information is going to be missing to the other people.
Yeah, just to clarify, then you're talking about the situation where there is a material effect on past service cost or the gain or loss in settlement, but it does not affect a significant number of employees.
Right. So I'm not talking about the impact on the past service cost.
Correct. Correct.
I'm just talking about the impact on the current service cost, future service cost and the net interest. So
yes.
What if that is big? That is not going to be reported if the proportion of the employees affected by the plan is insignificant.
Yes, in that case, we agreed the current service cost and net interest will not be updated in that box in the matrix, but we think that interaction where something would have a material impact on past service cost or the gain or loss in settlement but will not affect a significant number of employees, we think that population would be fairly limited in practice. It would be a consequence of introducing the practical criterion that we are proposing.
Yeah, I understand.
But we think
that
interaction would be rare in practice. So.
Right. I understand that this means the lactic two cells on this table is not going to be popular, very rare.
Yes.
I understand that. But whether there could be some significant impact on the current service cost and net interest.
But it would be a deferral until the next annual period rather than
but this
never.
Year it's not going to be a period.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah, you just want to recognize it in the.
But this year, that impact is not going to be up here in the balance sheet or income statement.
Correct.
That is only my concern.
Compared to balance sheet.
Yeah. Sandy, did you want to come in on this one?
Yeah, I guess I'm not so in favor of the significant number of employees. I'm more in favor of a materiality being decision being made by the company. Now, I'm not certain what this number without the current service cost and the net interest in the financial statements will really tell me. And I'm not certain that at the next remeasurement date, then is when I figure out that it was material. I mean, how does management make a decision? Because I would think, well, this is an accounting decision. There's also a management decision, and many of these things go to board. So wouldn't they want to know what the impact would be in the future, even when I remeasure? Because particularly if I've told the market something about what my earnings would be, and I know that people adjust for this and they take it out and they're like, I'm just not really certain what this number actually tells me. And I guess I would leave it to a materiality decision where management considers those things and what the future consequences would be. I just, a significant number of employees. I mean, I've been in a situation where, you know, they changed the benefit of the CEO and it was an enormous number. Right. So I don't know how the number of employees really helped you decide when talking to investors about what might happen with these numbers. So I guess I'm repeating myself, the materiality would be the way I would go.
Well, number of employees is already baked into 19, isn't it? On the curtailments.
Yes, and that's why we proposed this criterion as opposed to any other criterion.
So I think that the question is, how much do you want to amend?
Yeah. So if that was a decision we didn't like, we're going to repeat it. Yeah.
Two wrongs always make a right. Yeah. Point
that's eight. What I hear.
Other comments? I'm hearing general support for the approval. Oh, Bonnie, sorry.
Late entrant, perhaps, but I think I'm in the same spot as Tony, even after hearing all the comments, that I guess the way I had always thought about this proposal is that paragraph 99 says when you remeasure. When you remeasure, you look at your assumptions and you update them based on what the current situation is. I think, Martin, I guess the way I would answer your question is, I mean, at least practically speaking, we have a cadence on when we review our mortality, when we review other things. It would most likely be the discount rate change that would be the most impactful. I would say, especially under IFRS, where that's the rate you use for both your liability and your assets. So it has obviously an impact going forward when you change the discount rate, but I guess I don't see where the confusion lies, and I'm a little, I don't know, perplexed by that. Maybe it's because I'm reading it on the face and knowing what our intent was rather than the practical application. I guess the other comment I would make is if there's a settlement or a curtailment or a plan amendment under U.S. GAAP which would require us to remeasure, we would change the assumptions and it would have an impact going forward. So frankly, the fact that the new IAS 19, when we had a curtailment a couple of years ago, that it was different. We created an IFRS to U.S. GAAP difference in the service cost and the interest cost that lasted for half a year. It was a bit difficult to explain because A, nobody understands pensions in the first place, and B, this was an even further nonsensical difference between IFRS and U.S. GAAP, in addition to the other nonsensical differences. That's a different issue.
So, Anne, you're going to make sense out of nonsense, are you?
I doubt it now. I just wanted to reiterate that the concern coming out of the responses that I felt was a genuine concern was that you could have a material impact on the service costs and the interest costs going forward because of, say, changes in interest rates. And depending on which way they changed or the position that the company was in, some companies might want to put that change in the current service costs and the interest costs through, or they might not want to. And if we rely on materiality of the remeasurement under paragraph 99, and we don't sort of restrict the way that you assess that materiality, then the impact going forward could be very big, not because of the size of the plan event, but because of the change in interest rates. And so if we don't do something to control this, we are giving people the choice effectively of when to remeasure and when not to remeasure. And that is what worries me, which is why I think we do need some extra criteria rather than leaving it up to people to assess whether it's material. Because if you have no plan event, there could be a change in interest rates that would make, if you did apply it to the current service cost and interest cost going, would definitely be material. And in order to get that change, if they wanted it through, they just have to make some minor plan amendments and away they go. So that's why I think it's anti-abuse, I suppose, and maybe we shouldn't be putting that in. But relying on people's assessments of materiality, if we don't somehow curtail it or constrain it, I think is a bit worrying.
I'd like to jump in on that, because if we can't trust management to make materiality decisions related to this, then an investor would say, I don't trust management on many different things because they're making all sorts of materiality decisions. I don't really think it's an anti-abuse thing. When one of these things gets remeasured, I agree with Bonnie that many people don't understand pension accounting, but many organizations do have people who are pension specialists to help analysts and investors figure these things out. And there will be questions around it. So I don't worry about that because it will get a lot of attention and it will get scrutiny. So I guess that wouldn't be one of my concerns.
But it isn't a question of assessing materiality. I mean, if you think about a situation where there's been some substantial change in interest rates, which means that if you remeasured and used these new assumptions for your current service costs and your interest costs, it would have a material effect. And everybody would agree that it has a material effect. What we want to do is to put something in place that means that management doesn't have a choice effectively as to whether to use those new assumptions or whether not to use those new assumptions. And that's not to do with an assessment of materiality, because the change would be material. It's a question of, has something happened that would trigger a remeasurement? And if we don't constrain that, then we're giving them a choice. I'm sorry, I didn't explain that very well.
Well, just to follow on Ann's comment, is my recollection, rusty as it may be, of our discussions was, how do we, to use Ann's phrase from this morning, if pension accounting were perfect, we could remark the obligation daily.
Yeah.
But we can't.
No.
And that's the world we live in. And so when we came to this discussion, we were all, or I think a majority of the committee, was concerned about how do we constrain taking out all notions of earnings management, take all that off the table, just how do we constrain the number of situations in which you have to do this? And the question we're confronting right now is, I think some of the committee members would prefer a more general materiality criteria, perhaps believing that that's been what's in place already. Others find this overlay useful, and so maybe if we can focus our attentions that way, it would be useful. Andrew, I don't think you've been in on this one.
Thanks, Wayne. It was just a possible suggestion for how to unblock this, that it seems that what we're trying to focus on is, has something significant happened. So would it be possible then to look at it in terms of, has there been a significant effect on the absolute obligations of the plan? Because in that case, if you have one employee who happens to be the CEO who has a change made, which radically affects the plan, because of that individual, you'd pick it up. But if it's one employee who's 25, you won't. So perhaps just thinking about it in that context might help to focus us in on the right thing.
Okay, let's go around the table. Martin?
Yeah, probably with regard to Anne. Anne, would you agree that, I mean, your issue was opening up arbitrage for management, so to say. Yeah, so if you have a very high decrease of the interest rate, then probably no one wants to remeasure. On the other hand, if you have a high increase of interest rate, then probably, yeah. And probably would agree, if you do not change the input parameter where the management has no impact on, so the interest rate or so, for sure there would be no arbitrage possibility for management at all. So therefore, I focus so much on this kind of, say, what is the thinking beyond IRS 19, and what kind of parameters one really has to adjust? Because what I might have observed in practice, also for bigger adjustments, is that these kinds of parameters have been unadjusted so far. So either there is a huge misinterpretation on IRS 19, or so far there was a kind of, say, interpretation policy choice, which we know intend to narrow. But at least it probably was possible in the past. So why changing that?
Staff? I take that as more than a rhetorical question.
Thanks, Wayne.
I agree that if we didn't update the assumptions, except for the ones that the plan event affected, you would get rid of the issue that I'm worried about. I have to say, I hate the idea of updating some assumptions and not others. I just really find that, I don't know, like even more of a mixed measurement than sort of we have at the moment, but I wouldn't particularly support going down that route. And I thought, I mean, the reason I thought that we were doing the interpretation was because we were concerned that people, that there was diversity in practice about whether people were updating or not updating. So that's why we're taking it on, because we were worried about that.
John?
Yeah, just a couple of comments. I'm a bit confused by this issue about updating assumptions, because I thought paragraph 99 is quite clear that when you calculate the gain or loss on settlement, you actually have to use current, current assumptions, not just. So the idea of locking in some is probably just a materiality call rather than anything that's written in the standard. My recollection as well, when you talk about recollection of when we started this, my recollection of when we started this, and it may also be hazy, was that we thought that if you were remeasuring under paragraph 99, it seemed to make somewhat sense to actually remeasure current service costs and interest costs post that, because if you didn't, you ended up with potentially nonsense in those two measures. It was never, we were never driven, from my recollection, by any desire to constrain that in any way. And the discussion on constraining that is more about operationality, practicality, about whether you should do that updating in every situation when you have a paragraph 99 amendment or a paragraph 99 remeasurement, or only a subset of those. So that's my recollection. So I'm not a big fan of sort of anti-abuse provisions. I think if someone's doing a remeasurement under paragraph 99, they have all the current assumption information, because that's what paragraph 99 requires. And if they want to do a remeasurement post that, it seems to me that's better accounting, because you're using up-to-date assumptions to measure your obligation, your current service cost, and your interest cost.
Yeah, I agree. Just Gary, let's go one at a time.
I think when you do the curtailments or the amendments, as a practical matter, you're reconsidering all the assumptions. The fact that most of them are long-term assumptions, they might not change, but it's the discount rate is the one that's volatile, and you may or may not consider values of plan assets. The assumptions, long-term rate of return, you know, salary progression, those don't change in the short term. It really is the discount rate that's changing. Just another thing, we talk about impact on service and interest cost. Mechanically, for the most part, I think it's an effect on service costs, because your interest rate might change, but your liability goes in equal and offsetting effect, and they basically net. So it's really a service cost, more or less, is what's affected by the change of the discount rate.
Okay. Mary, and then Bertrand, and then I'm going to try and wrap it up.
My comment comes at it from a slightly different way, so you might want to take Bertrand first.
No, you go ahead.
Okay. Which is, I was prompted by Anne's comment about maybe there is an element of anti-abuse, et cetera, you know, in some of the thinking here. And I'm wondering if that is, you know, when the staff steps back and looks at the feedback, if that's a concern, maybe there's help already in the standards, and that's in IS 34 in paragraph B9 of the appendix. That paragraph says that pension cost for an interim period is calculated based on the end of the prior year, adjusted for significant market fluctuations since that time and for significant one-off events such as amendments, curtailments, and settlements. So in some ways, the requirement in here to update, you know, the interim calculation for significant market fluctuations, whether or not you've had an amendment, whether they're up or whether they're down. I mean, this may be a paragraph that people, perhaps because it's in a at least structurally non-authoritative appendix, might not be paying that much attention to, but it might be time to draw, maybe the opportunity to draw more attention is one of the factors that also is in play for interim reporting. Might be something to consider in thinking about the mix of responding to the concerns raised on the ED.
Okay, Bertrand, last call.
No, just to say that I concur with what Gary's said previously, and just to answer to John, when we effectively consider that there is a potential material impact due to a service plan amendment or a curtailment, we effectively remeasure the defined benefit obligation and then derive the service cost and the interest cost, and we reassess all assumptions to remeasure the defined benefit obligation as if we were doing the usual yearly process. And as Gary said, effectively, if you did a year-end valuation and 2 months after you have a curtailment or a service cost, or sorry, a plan amendment. I mean, it can probably that your assumption on the mortality table won't have changed a lot, for sure. And effectively, as Gary mentions, probably what will trigger the most significant impact would be effectively the discount rate. But never mind, we do reassess then if we are in this. But the interest I see in, I mean, because I have the impression that nobody is discussing the fact that you need to assess whether it's material or not. It's my understanding. And it's just that the agenda paper provides a specific way of interpreting what is material or not. And I think this is useful for at least two reasons, for internal control and for comparability between constituents. And so then let's go for it, because it provides an additional insight for it. But obviously, the mere principles that are discussed, we are applying them. If we have a significant impact, we remeasure everything, obviously, using the current assumptions as it is written in the standard, obviously.
Okay. We've reached the point in every meeting at which I feel constrained to remind the committee of two things. Number one, theoretically, most of you supported this when it went out as an exposure draft. And theoretically, the staff has attempted to be responsive to concerns raised by respondents. However, the resulting baby may be ugly. Let me see if I understand the two views. One view, as Bertrand just suggested, is that the staff has accomplished its tasks and supports the recommendations made by the staff. The other view, I think, as articulated again by that end of the table,
and Bonnie,
would be to revert, I don't want to say revert, but to move backward, back toward more general materiality criteria. Having seen the result of all of this, the materiality approach maybe wasn't so bad after all. So I think, again, it's a binary choice. So, show of hands, staff approach.
And the phone?
Five, and on the phone?
The non-staff approach.
Okay.
Materiality approach. I don't know which side of the table that makes me.
That puts you down to my left.
Okay.
With Tony and Carl and John there. Those who favor a straight mortality, excuse me. Materiality approach, show of hands. Okay, that's a majority. Nine with the phone. So that's a clear majority, that's what we'll do. Yeah, without this overlay that the staff has been working at. Okay. So that moves us on to the next issue.
Okay. The next issue two, inconsistencies with IS-34. As discussed in July, some respondents say that the decision not to address the accounting in IS-19 when significant market fluctuation occur will result in divergent practices. Some respondents think that paragraph B9 of IS-34 should be amended to be consistent with IS-19. Our analysis is presented in paragraph 27 to 33 of this paper. Both the interpretation committee and the board discussed this issue in some detail when developing the proposed amendment. On the basis of our analysis, we recommend not addressing the accounting when significant market fluctuations occur, because this is beyond the scope of this proposed narrow scope amendment. When drafting the final amendment, we will clarify that
entity would apply the amendment only when there is a plan event. I would like to turn attention to question 2 on page 11 and ask if you agree with our recommendation not to address the accounting when significant market fluctuations occur.
Recommendation, not.
Not to address.
Key word. Comments? Going once, going twice, sold. Go.
I'm going to be consistent. Something I said when we deliberated to begin with, I probably would be inclined to amend paragraph B9 of IS 34. I think the tension it creates is that it says you should be reconsidering your assumptions if there are significant market fluctuations. It says that in the context of interims. If you don't prepare interims, does that mean you don't consider significant market fluctuations? If that is the case, the frequency of reporting is going to affect your profit. So I think B9 is actually inconsistent with the rest of IS 34 because it will affect the outcome depending on the frequency with which you do your financial reporting. So I take the point that it's a separate issue to what we have just been talking about. But I just want—I guess my sense and the comments that we've had would be that this will be an opportunity to tidy it up.
Good.
Yes, ma'am.
You tidy it up by amending IS 34 rather than amending IS 19. Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, and so they pointed out. I'd be in the camp that you revisit your assumptions if you need to remeasure under paragraph 99, which we've just been talking about. But otherwise, I would leave it. Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else with that view?
Yeah, I mean, I would have a similar view, but I think not. I wouldn't do it here. I just think IS 34 has lots of other things. I would do it in an IS 34 project.
Okay.
We will now move on to the second proposed amendment, IS 19. The accounting for plan event may cause a reduction or elimination of surplus, which may mean that the effect of asset ceiling also changes. Consequently, the board also decided to amend IS 19 to clarify that an entity recognized past service cost or gain or loss on settlement separately from its assessment of the asset ceiling. The main concern raised by respondents on this proposed amendment is summarized in paragraph 37 of this paper. Notwithstanding these concerns, we maintain the view that proposed clarification is appropriate, and we recommend finalizing the proposed amendment for reasons outlined in paragraph 39 of the paper. Now, I would like to turn your attention on question 3 on page 14 and ask if you agree with our recommendation to retain the clarification that recognizing past service cost or gain or loss on settlement is a separate step from assessing the asset ceiling. Now I will hand over to you before moving on to question 4.
So this one got an awful lot of examples in the comment letters. People developed examples, and everybody's example was enough different that it was kind of a slog to get through them. John?
I agree with the staff recommendation. I think the recognition of gain or loss on settlement and past service cost is separate from the application of the asset ceiling. So I agree with this recommendation.
Sandy?
I don't have anything to add.
Tony?
I just wanted to say, to be inconsistent, that I agree with the staff recommendation.
Having gotten that endorsement, I see no reason to go on. So. Question 4.
So finally, for question 4 on page 14, I would like to ask if you have any comments on and if you agree with staff recommendation on the other issues outlined in Appendix A.
not seeing anybody jumping to the gun. Sandy, anything on this section?
Nope.
Nope. Okay. Then we will take it as given.